A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a big one. Operation Orchard, the 2007 Israeli airstrike that leveled a Syrian nuclear reactor. He's asking why Syria was pursuing a nuclear program at all, how sophisticated the facility actually was, how Israel kept the whole thing quiet and got the Americans on board, and then the big contemporary question. What parallels or contrasts do we see with the attacks on Iranian nuclear facilities that are in the headlines right now? How have IAF capabilities changed since 2007, and how does the targeting approach differ? There's a lot to unpack here.
The place to start is with the reactor itself, because most people hear Syrian nuclear reactor and picture something primitive, some slapped-together facility in a warehouse. That's not what this was. The reactor at Al-Kabar was a near-identical copy of North Korea's Yongbyon reactor, a gas-graphite-moderated design capable of producing weapons-grade plutonium. The Syrians didn't just buy components, they bought the entire North Korean playbook.
Which raises the first obvious question. Why North Korea? Syria had no real nuclear infrastructure, no domestic expertise to speak of. What was the connection?
The relationship went back years. North Korea had been exporting missile technology to Syria since the 1990s, Scud variants, production facilities. By the early 2000s, the cooperation deepened into the nuclear realm. We know from IAEA investigations afterward that North Korean nuclear personnel were physically present at Al-Kabar. The construction techniques, the reactor vessel design, the cooling system, it all matched Yongbyon. Syria paid for it, North Korea built it, and both countries maintained it never happened.
Even after the building was a crater.
Assad's government bulldozed the site, carted away the debris, and built a missile facility on top of it to hide the evidence. The IAEA wasn't allowed back. It took years of satellite imagery analysis to reconstruct what had been there.
They were going for a plutonium bomb. Why that route instead of uranium enrichment, which is what everyone focuses on with Iran?
It's a great question. Enrichment requires a massive industrial footprint, thousands of centrifuges, a supply chain for raw uranium, conversion facilities. It's hard to hide. A plutonium reactor, especially a gas graphite design, can be built in a single building. No need for a visible enrichment cascade stretching over acres. Syria's thinking was, build it in the desert, bury what you can, keep it off the IAEA radar, and you've got a plutonium production line that nobody knows about.
They almost got away with it.
The facility was weeks from going hot. The reactor core had been completed. The control rods were being installed. Another month or two, and it would have been operational. Once a reactor goes critical, bombing it becomes a much messier proposition. You're talking about dispersing radioactive material across the region.
Let's talk about how Israel found out. Because this wasn't satellite imagery from the Americans, right?
No. The discovery is a story in itself. In late 2006, Mossad obtained a laptop from a Syrian nuclear official staying at a hotel in Vienna. The operation involved getting into his room, copying the hard drive, and getting out. What they found was astonishing. Photographs of the reactor interior, North Korean personnel, detailed construction plans. It was the complete record of the project.
A laptop in a Vienna hotel room. The entire Syrian nuclear program exposed because someone brought work home.
It's almost absurd, but it tracks. Intelligence failures are usually not about missing some brilliantly hidden secret. They're about human carelessness. This official had photographs of the reactor core, of the control room, of North Korean engineers standing next to Syrian counterparts. The Mossad analysts couldn't believe what they were seeing.
Then the hard part, convincing the Americans.
This is where it gets delicate. Israel took the intelligence to the CIA in early 2007. The reaction was skepticism, and for understandable reasons. The intelligence community had been burned on WMD claims in Iraq just a few years earlier. Nobody wanted to endorse a preemptive strike based on photographs from a laptop. The CIA conducted their own analysis, and here's the fascinating detail. They concluded it was a reactor, but they wanted more time to build the diplomatic case. Israel's assessment was different. There wasn't time.
Because of the operational timeline.
Once that reactor went critical, the strike window closed. You can't bomb a hot reactor without causing an environmental catastrophe. The Israelis calculated they had until roughly September 2007. The Bush administration was divided. Vice President Cheney reportedly supported military action. Secretary of State Rice wanted a diplomatic approach. Defense Secretary Gates was deeply cautious. In the end, the U.S. didn't give a green light, but they also didn't stop Israel. It was a nod and wink.
Which is a pattern we've seen repeated.
And it's worth noting that the strike itself was not just about destroying a building. The Israeli Air Force had to penetrate Syrian air defenses, strike the target with precision, and get everyone home. They used F-15Is and F-16Is, the long-range strike variants flying through Turkish airspace, which Turkey was not thrilled about, and hitting the facility in the Deir ez-Zor region of eastern Syria.
The Syrian air defenses?
Israel deployed an electronic warfare system that essentially blinded Syrian radar. It's since been reported that they used a cyber attack on the Syrian air defense network, one of the earliest known uses of offensive cyber in a kinetic military operation. Syrian radar operators were seeing clear skies while Israeli jets were overhead. The system was called Suder, developed by BAE Systems, and it allowed the attacking aircraft to essentially become invisible to the integrated air defense network.
You've got a reactor in the desert, North Korean engineers, a laptop in Vienna, electronic warfare that makes jets disappear from radar, and a strike that takes out the facility in minutes. No casualties on the Israeli side, no aircraft lost.
The Syrian response was almost nothing. They condemned it, but they didn't retaliate. They couldn't admit what the facility was without acknowledging they'd been running a covert nuclear program in violation of their NPT commitments. So they were trapped. If they made a big deal of it, they'd have to explain what got bombed. Their silence was their admission.
The perfect operation, in some ways. But it didn't end Syria's nuclear ambitions entirely, did it?
It ended their plutonium path. There have been subsequent reports of smaller-scale enrichment research, but nothing that approached a weapons program. The strike achieved its objective. It removed the near-term threat and signaled very clearly that Israel would not tolerate a nuclear Syria.
Let's pivot to the parallel with Iran, because this is where the prompt gets really interesting. We're in June 2026. Over the past few years, there have been multiple reported strikes on Iranian nuclear facilities, some attributed to Israel, some more ambiguous. How does the targeting philosophy compare?
It's fundamentally different, and understanding why tells you everything about how the threat has evolved. Al-Khaibar was a single facility. Find it, destroy it, mission accomplished. Iran's nuclear program is distributed across dozens of sites, many of them deep underground. Natanz, Fordow, Isfahan, these aren't above-ground buildings in the desert. Fordow is buried under a mountain. You can't just drop a bunker buster and call it a day.
The single-strike model doesn't apply.
Not at all. The Iranian approach has been what analysts call salami slicing, not destroying facilities outright, but degrading specific capabilities. Sabotage at centrifuge plants, cyber attacks like Stuxnet, targeted killings of nuclear scientists, precision strikes on centrifuge assembly halls. The goal isn't to eliminate the program in one blow, it's to set it back, repeatedly, and to impose costs that make the program unsustainable.
The death by a thousand cuts approach.
And there's another key difference. Syria's program was covert. Assad denied it even existed. Iran's program, parts of it at least, is declared and under IAEA safeguards, even if the IAEA has been increasingly frustrated with access restrictions. Bombing a declared nuclear facility is a different legal and diplomatic category than bombing a secret one.
The Al-Khaibar strike was clean. In a strategic sense, the target was unambiguous. The Syrian denial made the aftermath manageable. With Iran, every strike is messy, every target is contested, and the diplomatic fallout is enormous.
The military challenge is exponentially harder. In 2007, the IAF was penetrating Syrian airspace, which is not nothing, but it's also not the most advanced integrated air defense network in the world. Iran has Russian-supplied S-300 systems, indigenous air defense capabilities, and a much larger geographic depth. A strike on Fordo requires flying over multiple countries, suppressing layered defenses, and penetrating a mountain.
Which brings us to how the IAF has changed since 2007. What's actually different about the platforms?
The most significant change is the F-35. Israel was the first country outside the United States to operate the F-35 operationally. They've used it in combat since 2018. The F-35 brings stealth, sensor fusion, and electronic warfare capabilities that simply didn't exist in 2007. The F-15Is and F-6Is that flew the Al-Khaibar mission were highly capable fourth-generation aircraft, but they relied on external electronic warfare support to penetrate Syrian airspace. An F-35 carries that capability organically.
You don't need a separate suitor-like system to blind the radars. The aircraft itself is the blinding system.
And the weapons have evolved too. Israel has developed a range of precision-guided munitions that can penetrate hardened targets. The GBU-28 Bunker Buster was the gold standard for years, but there are now Israeli-developed weapons with even greater penetration capability. Plus, Israel has invested heavily in standoff weapons, missiles that can be launched from outside the range of air defenses, which changes the risk calculus entirely. Massive drone capability. Israel uses UAVs for surveillance, targeting, and increasingly for strike missions. The combination of stealthy F-35s penetrating enemy airspace, drones providing persistent surveillance, and standoff weapons launched from safe distances. It's a completely different operational model from 2007.
Here's what I keep coming back to. The Al-Khaibar strike was a single mission. One night, one target, done. The Iranian campaign, if we can call it that, has been ongoing for years. Does that reflect a different strategic calculus? Or just the reality that you can't solve the Iran problem with a single strike?
It's both. There's no single target in Iran whose destruction would eliminate the program. The knowledge, the supply chains, the hidden facilities, the centrifuge manufacturing capacity are all distributed. But there's also a strategic choice at work. A full-scale bombing campaign against Iran would risk a regional war. The salami-slicing approach allows Israel to degrade the program while managing escalation. It's not flashy, but it's been effective. Iran's breakout time has been pushed back repeatedly.
Breakout time? Define that for listeners who hear it in headlines, but might not know what it actually means.
It's the time required to produce enough weapons-grade uranium for a single nuclear weapon, starting from the enriched uranium Iran has already stockpiled. When the JCPOA was signed in 2015, the breakout time was estimated at about a year. By late 2025, after Iran had enriched uranium to 60% and accumulated a large stockpile, some estimates put the breakout time at just a few weeks. The campaign of sabotage and targeted strikes has been aimed at stretching that timeline back out.
The metric of success isn't, did you destroy the facility? It's, did you add 6 months to the breakout clock?
That's exactly how the defense establishment thinks about it. And it's a much harder metric to communicate to the public. A crater in the desert is viscerally satisfying. A centrifuge cascade that's running 10% slower because of a cyber attack is invisible.
Which creates a political challenge. Governments want to demonstrate results. A covert campaign of degradation doesn't produce photo ops.
No, and that's part of why these operations remain officially unacknowledged. Israel has never formally confirmed its role in the strikes on Natanz or the killing of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, the head of Iran's nuclear weapons program. The ambiguity serves multiple purposes. It gives Iran a ladder to climb down. It avoids triggering a formal casus belli, and it allows the international community to look the other way.
Whereas with Al-Khaibar, the silence was different. Syria couldn't acknowledge the strike because they couldn't acknowledge the facility. With Iran, everyone knows what's happening, but nobody says it out loud.
The unspoken acknowledgement is a diplomatic tool in itself. It's the equivalent of a raised eyebrow across the table. Everyone understands. Nobody has to escalate.
Let's talk about the intelligence dimension, because that's another area where the contrast is instructive. The Al-Khaibar intelligence came from a single source, a laptop. The Iranian program requires persistent, multi-source intelligence across years. How has that capability evolved?
Israel's intelligence apparatus now integrates signals. Intelligence, human intelligence, cyber espionage, and satellite imagery in ways that were aspirational in 2007. Unit A-200, the IDF's Signals Intelligence Unit has become arguably the most capable cyber and SIGINT organization outside the Five Eyes alliance. The Mossad has developed deep penetration of the Iranian nuclear establishment. The fact that they were able to steal the entire nuclear archive from a warehouse in Tehran in 2018 tells you how extensive that penetration is.
The archive heist is worth pausing on. In 2018, Mossad operatives broke into a warehouse in Tehran, extracted tens of thousands of documents and CDs detailing Iran's nuclear weapons research, and got the entire haul out of the country without being detected. That's not a laptop in Vienna. That's a heist movie.
It changed the intelligence picture fundamentally. The archive confirmed that Iran had pursued nuclear weaponization, the actual design and engineering of a warhead, through a program called the Ahmad Plan, which Iran had always denied. The documents included designs for a nuclear warhead, testing plans, and organizational charts. It was the smoking gun that Iran had claimed didn't exist.
The intelligence game has moved from opportunistic collection to systematic penetration, which feeds directly into targeting.
You can't do precision strikes on centrifuge assembly halls if you don't know where they are, what they look like, and when they're operating. The 2018 archive heist provided a roadmap of the Iranian program that has informed targeting decisions for years afterward.
One thing the prompt asks about is how the targeting differs. We've talked about single facility versus distributed network, but there's also the question of what you're actually aiming at. With Al-Kibar, it was the reactor vessel. Destroy that, you destroy the plutonium production capability. With Iran, what are the aim points?
It depends on the objective. The sabotage operations have targeted centrifuge production. If Iran can't manufacture advanced centrifuges domestically, their enrichment capacity degrades over time as machines break and can't be replaced. Other strikes have hit centrifuge assembly halls, power supplies, and control systems. There have also been strikes on weapons development sites, facilities associated with the weaponization work, not just enrichment. The killing of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh in 2020 was a major blow. He was the intellectual architect of the weapons program, the man who understood how all the pieces fit together. You can rebuild a centrifuge hall. Replacing someone like Fakhrizadeh is much harder. The institutional knowledge, the networks of expertise, the ability to solve novel engineering problems, those walk out the door with the person.
Which is a different kind of targeting entirely. It's not about infrastructure. It's about human capital.
It's deeply controversial. Targeted killings of scientists raise legal and ethical questions that bombing a building doesn't. But from a strategic perspective, it's been one of the most effective tools for slowing the program.
If we're drawing the big contrast between 2007 and now, single target versus distributed network, acknowledged strike versus ambiguous campaign, destruction versus degradation, infrastructure versus human capital, Syrian airspace versus Iranian airspace, fourth generation fighters with external EW support versus stealth platforms with organic capabilities.
That's the summary right there. But I think there's one more dimension worth exploring, the diplomatic context. In 2007, the Bush administration was in its final years. The Iraq War was going badly, and there was no appetite for another Middle Eastern conflict. The diplomatic environment was permissive in a negative sense. Nobody wanted to stop Israel, but nobody wanted to help either. Now the landscape is far more complex. The Abraham Accords have normalized relations between Israel and several Arab states, some of which share Israel's concerns about Iran. Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Bahrain. These countries see Iran's nuclear program as an existential threat. That creates opportunities for intelligence sharing, overflight permissions, and quiet diplomatic coordination that simply didn't exist in 2007.
The enemy of my enemy dynamic.
It's more than that. It's a realignment of regional security architecture. The threat perception of Iran has created a de facto alignment between Israel and the Sunni Gulf states that would have been unthinkable 20 years ago. That changes the operational calculus. You have more options for basing, for intelligence collection, for diplomatic cover.
Yet the Iranians keep building. They've weathered sanctions, sabotage, assassination, and they're closer to a weapon than they've ever been, depending on which estimates you believe.
That's the uncomfortable reality. The campaign of degradation has slowed the program, but it hasn't stopped it. The knowledge is there, the infrastructure is hardened, and the regime has made a strategic decision to absorb the costs. The question that hangs over all of this, and I don't think anyone has a good answer, is whether a campaign of pinprick strikes can ultimately prevent a determined state from acquiring nuclear weapons, or whether it just delays the inevitable.
That's the billion-dollar question. Or the trillion-dollar question, really.
It's not just about Iran. The Al-Khobar strike worked because Syria was at the beginning of its nuclear journey. They didn't have the knowledge base, the distributed infrastructure, or the hardened facilities. Iran is at a completely different stage. The lessons of 2007 don't translate cleanly.
One thing I wonder about, and this is speculative, is whether the Al-Khobar strike actually made the Iranian program harder to stop. By demonstrating that above ground, single facility programs are vulnerable, Israel may have inadvertently pushed Iran toward the hardened, distributed model that's now so difficult to counter.
That's a fascinating argument. I think there's something to it. The Iranians watched what happened to the Osirak reactor in Iraq in 1981, they watched Al-Khobar in 2007, and they learned the lesson, if you build a single visible facility, it will be bombed. So they went underground, literally and figuratively. Fordow is buried in a mountain for a reason. The distributed centrifuge production sites exist for a reason. The operational security is tighter for a reason.
Success in 2007 made the 2026 problem harder.
In a perverse way, yes. But the alternative, allowing Syria to acquire a nuclear weapon, would have been far worse. The choice was between a harder future problem and an immediate catastrophic problem. Israel chose the harder future problem.
Let's talk about the Turkish dimension, because that's an angle that doesn't get enough attention. The Al-Khobar strike route went through Turkish airspace. Turkey was not consulted, was not happy about it, and there were diplomatic repercussions. How does that compare to the overflight challenges with Iran?
The Turkish overflight in 2007 was audacious. The IAF jets entered Turkish airspace near the Mediterranean coast and flew east toward Syria. They dropped external fuel tanks along the route, some of which were found in Turkey, which is how the overflight was confirmed. Turkey protested, but the diplomatic fallout was manageable. With Iran, the overflight challenge is much harder. The direct route from Israel to Iran passes over Jordan and Iraq, or alternatively, over Saudi Arabia. Each of those countries has its own political calculus. The Abraham Accords have changed the equation with some Gulf states, but Iraq is a different story. Iranian influence there is significant, and overflight would be politically explosive.
The operational routes are more constrained, even as the platforms have improved.
That's why standoff weapons and long-range strike capabilities have become so important. If you can launch a missile from Israeli airspace that reaches Iran, you don't need overflight at all. Or, if you can launch from a submarine in the Arabian Sea, you bypass the overflight problem entirely. Israel has invested heavily in both of those capabilities.
Submarines. That's the Dolphin class, right?
Yes, the Dolphin-class submarines, which are widely believed to carry nuclear-capable cruise missiles, but they can also carry conventional precision strike weapons. A submarine operating off the coast of Iran is a strategic asset that doesn't require anyone's permission.
The strike envelope has expanded enormously since 2007. It's not just about better planes. It's about more ways to deliver effects.
More kinds of effects. In 2007, the only tool was a bomb. Now there's cyber, sabotage, targeted killing, drone strikes, electronic warfare, and probably capabilities we don't know about. The menu is longer, and the chefs are more creative.
The menu is longer, and the chefs are more creative. That's a grim way to put it, but accurate.
I'm a donkey who reads defense white papers. This is what you get.
Let's come back to something the prompt asked about directly. The coordination with the Americans. How did the Bush administration actually handle this internally? And how does it compare to the U.S.-Israel dynamic on Iran today?
The Bush administration was split. Cheney was reportedly in favor of the strike, seeing it as consistent with the administration's counter-proliferation posture. Condoleezza Rice preferred a diplomatic path. Take the intelligence to the IAEA, build international pressure, give Syria a chance to come clean. Bob Gates, the Secretary of Defense, was the most cautious. He'd seen how bad intelligence had led to the Iraq War, and he was deeply skeptical of acting on a single source, even one as compelling as the laptop photographs. Bush heard the Israeli case, didn't give explicit approval, but also didn't try to stop it. The message was essentially, we see the same intelligence, we agree it's a reactor, we understand why you feel you have to act, and we won't stand in your way. But we're not going to participate.
Which is basically what happened with the Osirak strike in 1981. The Reagan administration condemned it publicly, but was privately relieved.
There's a long tradition of that dynamic. Public condemnation for international consumption, private acknowledgement that the strike served shared interests.
Today? With Iran?
It's more complicated. The Trump administration that returned in 2025 has been more openly supportive of Israeli action against Iran than previous administrations. There have been joint exercises, intelligence sharing is deeper than ever, and the U.S. has conducted its own strikes on Iranian proxies and IRGC targets. The taboo against acknowledging Israeli operations has eroded somewhat, though not completely.
The maximum pressure approach.
Yes, though maximum pressure has had mixed results. It's damaged the Iranian economy, but it hasn't changed the regime's strategic calculus on the nuclear program. If anything, the Iranians have accelerated enrichment in response to pressure, betting that a nuclear deterrent is their ultimate insurance policy against regime change.
We're in a cycle. Pressure leads to acceleration, which leads to sabotage, which leads to hardening, which makes sabotage harder.
It's a spiral, and it's not clear where the off-ramp is. The Al-Kabar strike had a clean endpoint. The facility was destroyed, the program was stopped, and that was that. The Iranian campaign has no obvious endpoint. You can degrade centrifuges, kill scientists, and steal archives indefinitely, but at some point the program reaches a level of redundancy and hardening where those tactics stop working.
Which brings us back to the fundamental question. Can you bomb a nuclear program out of existence?
The historical evidence says no, not once it's reached a certain level of maturity. You can delay it, degrade it, and impose costs on it. But the knowledge doesn't go away. The scientists can be replaced. The centrifuges can be rebuilt. The only thing that permanently stops a nuclear program is a change in the regime's strategic calculus. Either they decide it's not worth the cost, or the regime itself changes.
That's a much bigger project than any airstrike.
And it's not one that can be accomplished by military means alone. Sanctions, diplomacy, internal pressure, intelligence operations, it's a whole-of-government effort that takes decades.
The Al-Kabar strike was the exception, not the rule. A clean, decisive operation against a program that hadn't yet matured. The Iranian campaign is the new normal. Ambiguous, protracted, and inconclusive.
That's the uncomfortable reality that defense planners have to grapple with. The age of the single decisive strike is probably over. The future is a long, grinding campaign of attrition against a distributed, hardened, and determined adversary.
One last question, and it's something I've been turning over. The Syrians built Al-Kibar with North Korean help. The Iranians have had help from Pakistan, from Russia, from North Korea, from the A. The proliferation problem is fundamentally a network problem. Knowledge and technology flow across borders. How much of the counter-proliferation effort is about disrupting those networks rather than striking the facilities they produce?
That's exactly the right frame. Khan Networks supplied centrifuge technology to Iran, Libya, and North Korea. It was the Walmart of nuclear proliferation. Disrupting that network in the early 2000s was one of the most significant counter-proliferation successes ever, and it was done almost entirely through intelligence and diplomacy, not military strikes. The lesson is that the network is the vulnerability. Facilities are the symptom.
The smart play is upstream. Stop the knowledge transfer. Interdict the components. Sanction the suppliers.
That's where intelligence is most valuable. The laptop in Vienna wasn't just about Al-Kabar. It revealed the North Korea-Syria proliferation channel. The Iranian Nuclear Archive didn't just confirm past weaponization. It identified suppliers, front companies, and procurement networks that are still active. Every piece of intelligence about the network is more valuable than intelligence about a single facility, because the network is how the next facility gets built.
If we're drawing the big lesson from 2007 to 2026, it's that the target set has shifted. In 2007, the target was a building. In 2026, the target is a network, and networks are much harder to kill.
That's why the campaign looks the way it does. It's diffuse, it's ambiguous, it's never quite finished. Because you're not trying to destroy a thing, you're trying to disrupt a system.
The Glockenspiel of counter-proliferation.
I don't know what that means, but I'm going to pretend I do.
I don't either. It just felt right. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1930s, a marine biologist off Cape Verde documented that a single giant squid's beak could exert enough pressure to crack a coconut, roughly equivalent to a human biting through a bowling ball, if bowling balls had shells and humans had beaks.
Right. Where does this leave us? Operation Orchard was a masterpiece of intelligence, planning, and execution, but it was also a snapshot of a particular moment in proliferation history that's unlikely to be repeated. The Iranian challenge is messier, longer, and more resistant to clean solutions. The IAF has transformed from a fourth-generation force reliant on external electronic warfare to a fifth-generation force with organic stealth, cyber capabilities, and a much broader strike envelope. The targeting has shifted from facilities to networks, from infrastructure to human capital, from destruction to degradation. And the diplomatic context has been reshaped by the Abraham Accords, by changes in American politics, and by an Iranian regime that has learned the lessons of Osirak and Al-Kiba and buried its program accordingly.
That's about as good a summary as we're going to get. The one thing I'd add is that the Al-Kibar strike succeeded not just because of military capability, but because of strategic clarity. The target was unambiguous, the timeline was clear, and the diplomatic groundwork had been laid. Those conditions are much harder to create today. The lesson for the future is that military capability is necessary but not sufficient. You need the intelligence, the diplomatic preparation, and the strategic patience to see it through.
The thing nobody wants to hear about and everybody needs.
The least popular virtue in international security.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping this show running. And thanks to everyone listening. This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com. And if you want to support the show, leave us a review wherever you listen. It genuinely helps.
See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.